Okay, well, we'd like to welcome the two of you to the April session of the Nebraska Court of Appeals. My name is Larry Welch from Plattsburgh, Nebraska. I'm pleased to be joined here today by Chief Judge Mike Pirtle of Omaha on my right and Judge David Arterburn of Sicilian on our left. We've been doing this remotely for a while. We're pleased to be back here live again today. We have four cases on the call today. Yours is the second. I'll call it here in a moment. Before we do, a couple reminder about COVID procedures. Number one, when you do approach, if you would lower your mask or remove it so that we can hear you. And second, when you do leave today, if you would exit out the side door as opposed to the back. Just a reminder that we are live streaming this today. We record these or archive, so the public nature of these are such that if you have any confidential matter, please keep be cognizant of that and with respect to your remarks today. Okay, the next matter on our call is case number A20-0607. That's State versus Califf. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
I believe it's Califf. I said something right now, it doesn't matter.
Okay, State versus Califf, if you would please approach.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Sean Reagan appearing on behalf of the appellant, Phaedrus Califf. Can't get used to that.
I understand.
Once it's on, it's on. Sean Reagan appearing on behalf of appellant Phaedrus Califf. May please the court counsel. I do have co-counsel. She's not here today, though. Your Honors, number one, thank you. It is good to be back in person. Interesting times we're in, but this case in particular, it's a unique case. This started out in county court. It was the appellant was charged with three counts of third degree sexual assault. Jury convicted him on count two. Counts one and three were not guilties. Appealed timely to the district court, got a new counsel because the gist of the district court, the appeal, the district court was ineffective assistance of counsel at the county court level. Well, we get to district court, appellate counsel, then the bill of exceptions is filed. Appellate counsel, though, doesn't file the statement of errors until two and a half months later. Of course, there's a court rule that says that statement of errors on an appeal from county to district has to be within 10 days. So that kind of leads us to where we are now. Judge McManaman in the Lancaster County District Court affirmed the county court, and then appellant appealed. Third counsel was again appointed. That's me, and I'm here today. So, Your Honors, first assignment of error here really is kind of the big one, obviously, is this. Obviously, we know in Strickland, Washington, what the two-prong test is for ineffective assistance of counsel. The appeal from county to district, again, appellate counsel had 10 days from the time the bill of exceptions was filed to file that statement of errors. Didn't do it in time, so the district court said, hey, you're limited to plain error. I'm not going to pay attention to any of these other things. It's plain error that I'm looking for, and that's that. Our argument at this point is, at that point right there, we've all kind of missed some deadlines. All of us have, once or twice or maybe even more. And we've all had to fall on our swords and try to remedy that. And this one, while it may not be as egregious as failing to file, for example, a personal injury action outside the statute of limitations, it's still pretty egregious to the point that it denied Mr. Califf, the appellant in this case, to point to specific things and instead have to rely on that umbrella catch-all provision of plain error. The state in its brief, and I assume Mr. List will argue, well, you know, it doesn't matter whether he was able to file that statement of errors in time or not, because if we look at each one of those statement of errors, they're all meritless. They lack merit. Okay. And setting that aside for 1 second, obviously our profession, we come under some scrutiny from the public. You hear about ambulance chasers, you hear all the derogatory terms and derivative terms that are used for attorneys. But something like this where there's such a deadline that's missed so egregiously, and it denies an appellant the ability to point to specific things and say, these are the errors that I want you to correct, Your Honor. That obviously prejudice is right of appeal, gives the public the perception, a negative perception of attorneys and the profession itself, and causes obviously unnecessary stress and anxiety to.
Where was he prejudiced in this situation?
Well, as I mentioned before, Your Honor, here's where the prejudice, and it is, again, it's a general prejudice, lies, is this, is instead of being able to point to things, he has to then rely on, and we all know this, the catch-all provision. Well, if you don't assign something as error, Your Honors can still take note of plain error that appears on the record. So if you look at the Bill of Exceptions from the district court, you can see the appellate counsel arguing his statement of errors, and then you can see the district court shutting him down, saying, no, you didn't file that in time. So why would I, the only thing I'm going to look at is plain error.
But don't you have to show us that if the statement of errors had been timely filed, that it would have made a difference to the district court?
Well, yes and no, because let me explain that, because I think that we have to take the approach then as the third counsel of record, the second appellate counsel, we have to figure out, well, where exactly is the prejudice? And you're absolutely right, Your Honor. And there's a couple of issues here, and I can work kind of backwards on them, because I can take care of the stuff which is probably, and I would almost say admittedly, not prejudicial necessarily. One of the statement of errors involved a Jackson v. Deno hearing, failing to present evidence at a Jackson v. Deno hearing. Now,
what evidence should have been presented at that hearing?
That's why I'm starting with the one I probably said is admittedly, the least prejudicial, is because at that hearing, what the defense counsel needed to do is just simply try to blow holes in that and say, look, there's an admission or some sort of admission that wasn't voluntarily, knowingly, and intelligently given. Now, in the Jackson v. Deno, in this case, what happens is they get to that point in the trial. Judge Acton stops the trial, has a Jackson v. Deno hearing, but then overrules or allows the evidence to keep coming in.
Is this the phone and text?
Yeah, and the state, again, I started off with what they said was probably the easiest one. The state's absolutely right. Said, well, you don't make any explicit confessions. So to that end, that's the easiest result of these issues. But I think that there's there was a motion in limine about methamphetamine use. Well, if you have a jury who is able to hear from a lay witness that the defendant is smoking methamphetamine, that's going to be prejudicial. Now, I know there's always degrees of prejudice in all evidence across the board. That's what we do. We try to prejudice against the other side as much as we can. Does the prejudicial value outweigh the probative effect? There's a motion in limine about that wasn't preserved. The objection wasn't preserved, I don't believe, going back through to the Bill of Exceptions.
Let me ask you this. In this case where he was found not guilty of two of the three charges, does that create a problem for you in arguing that he was prejudiced by that? As opposed to had he been convicted of all of the charged counts?
Or if you're asking me if once I took this court appointment and did this appeal, if I thought that, probably. I probably felt a little bit of a conflict because this court could reverse and remand for trial, and Mr. Koloff could be found guilty on all three. He could be found guilty or not guilty on all three. But
well, that's really not possible. I mean, he can't be found guilty for something he's already been found not guilty of.
True.
But I mean, really, if you got the relief you're asking for, we send it back to the district court, let you file your statement of errors and start there. I mean, that's the area that that's what you're arguing.
Well, and absolutely.
You want to be able to argue that those things were wrong.
Absolutely.
In the county court, but you really. But you're not asking us to send it back to the county court, are you?
No, I'm. You're right. I mean, at this point, where I'm at, as far as in this stage of proceedings, is, and I'd like to reserve 1 minute. I probably should have said that. Sorry. In this stage of proceedings, where we're at, is, number one, statement of errors wasn't timely filed. At that point, he's stuck with plain error. That's all that we can ask the court to take a look at. Okay. Now, obviously, to take some creative liberties, we have to say, okay, well, there's plain error because the evidence is not sufficient to sustain a conviction. It is plain error that you can take notice of because this motion in limine wasn't properly preserved. Those are some things that we obviously argue. And when you look at the real quick, I'm going to try to squeeze through this real quick. Again, talking about the methamphetamine. Okay. It's a lay witness. There's an objection. It's overruled. The motion in limine is overruled, but that objection isn't preserved for purposes of appeal. And that is in the statement of errors. That is what should be, pardon me. So that is one of the main things. In addition, evidence not being sufficient to sustain the conviction. I said I was going to retain a minute. I'm not going to. I'm just going to try to plow through this. Evidence not sufficient to sustain the conviction. He's convicted on count two. Count one involved sexual contact with breast. Count three involved sexual contact by the appellant allegedly putting his penis on the person of AK. Count two involved touching AK's buttocks. I know this court's not here to reweigh testimony. I know this court is not here to pass on credibility of witnesses. There's a AK doesn't report the buttocks touching to the same nurse. The DNA evidence doesn't support it necessarily. There's a lot of where there's smoke, most of the times there's fire. There's a lot of issues with that particular count. And I'm out of time. I'm asking the court, obviously, to find the evidence was not sufficient to sustain the conviction. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel, Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appalachian State of Nebraska. There are two overarching claims in this appeal. Number one, that appellate counsel was ineffective for failing to file a timely statement of errors in the district court. And number two, that the district court erred by failing to find plain error regarding the admission at trial of Khalaf's alleged meth use. We maintain that both claims are without merit. As far as the first overarching claim regarding appellate counsel's failure to file a timely statement of errors on appeal, I guess first and foremost, this wasn't necessarily expressly addressed by the appellant's argument here today, but I did just want to quickly address the notion that maybe there's an undertone of presumed prejudice in this case that seemed to be what opposing counsel was getting at, and we would submit that there's not. This would be a Strickland analysis, not a presumption of prejudice or a presumption of ineffective assistance of counsel. I would point to prior decisions in State v. Sundquist, this court's decision in State v. Steubendick, as well as State v. Assad for the notion that when something of this nature happens, we are applying Strickland, not a simple presumption of prejudice. With that in mind, we maintain that appellate counsel's failure to file the timely statement of errors fails because all four of the underlying claims would have been unsuccessful even if that statement of errors had been timely and properly filed. So the appellant can't show prejudice from his appellate counsel's failure to file the timely statement of errors. I can briefly walk through each of these claims, or one or two of them, or none of them, if the court.
I want to talk about the methamphetamine, the testimony by her that.
Okay.
Why was that not a problem?
Well, first of all, as far as how this claim, that claim was not presented in the statement of errors, but the appellant's claiming that the district court nonetheless committed plain error on appeal by not finding error with the admission of that, i.e., that the county court erred by admitting it, or that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to prevent the admission of that evidence. As an initial matter, we question whether this claim is even properly before you with the nature of how it's been alleged here on appeal. But in any event, even if it is properly before you, we submit it without merit. Getting to the merits, as far as the assertion that the district court committed plain error by not finding that evidence was improperly admitted, we submit this claim fails because by plain error by definition applies only to matters that were not complained of below. This matter was presented and complained of below, so it does not and cannot qualify as plain error.
But if the statement of errors had been filed, then it would have been properly before the district court.
If the statement of errors had been properly, well, no, that claim wasn't in the statement of errors. which is why I'm questioning whether it's even properly before you, because they're trying to use plain error to raise a new claim that was never presented even in any capacity to the district court. It's a bit odd because I've never seen a case quite like this, so it's.
I haven't seen one like this either.
Right, procedurally, it's a bit of a labyrinth, and I think to have properly presented that now, it probably should have been alleged as a claim, another layered claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel for not only failing to file a timely statement of errors, but failing to include that claim in the statement of errors, which they haven't alleged here on appeal. So that's why we raised that question. But in any event, in response to your question about our take on it, it wouldn't be plain error on the district court. It cannot qualify as plain error. And then to the extent they're attempting to raise this as a claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel, again, I don't know that you can go there as a matter of plain error, several levels removed, but even to the extent you can, we'd submit they can't show deficient performance or prejudice on this claim. They can't show deficient performance because trial counsel did, in fact, file a motion in limine with respect to that evidence and sought to keep that evidence out, unfortunately lost. But trial counsel did what they're saying trial counsel should have done. And from a prejudice standpoint, we'd submit they can't show prejudice on that claim because, first of all, I'm not sure what basis there would have been to exclude that evidence. I don't think it was improperly admitted. And secondly, there's not a reasonable probability that but for the admission of that evidence, the result of trial would have been different here, especially in light of the fact that the jury heard that very evidence and still acquitted him on two of the three convictions. So we just don't see what harm there was given the verdicts in this case. So on that claim, whether it's viewed as a matter of plain error or a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel or both, we maintain that Mr. Kolof is not entitled to relief on that claim. I don't have anything further on that. And if the court doesn't have any questions on the statement of errors and those underlying claims, I won't waste your time walking through those, but I'm certainly happy to entertain.
What's the state's position on the Jackson v. Deno? Does Jackson v. Deno even apply to an undercover, in essence, an undercover discussion or talk with a defendant when they don't know that they're talking to the police?
To my knowledge, no. I don't see why. Well, and that was the county court's take that this wouldn't seem to apply here. Because I just don't see why it's really any different than just a regular controlled call. Especially when you have a situation as this where the defendant doesn't even know. I mean, per their own allegations, he didn't even know that he was speaking with law enforcement. So I'm not, from a Jackson v. Deno in a voluntariness standpoint, I'm not sure where the distinction would lie. I mean, behind the scenes, we know that it's an officer pretending to be the victim rather than the victim making the call. But practically speaking, in effect, the defendant doesn't even know that. So I don't see how it has any bearing on, the voluntariness of the defendant's statements. In terms of how I briefed it, I really didn't go into that because the claim was just the trial counsel didn't do enough in handling that. And I viewed that as an insufficient allegation of deficient performance because they just said counsel didn't present any evidence with no further specificity as to what counsel should have supposedly done differently. And from a prejudice standpoint, I just didn't see that claim going anywhere because our case law is pretty clear that in order for something to render statements involuntary, you typically have to have some sort of coercion involved. And there just wasn't any here, especially when, again, he himself is acknowledging that he didn't even know it was police he was communicating with. So there certainly was no coercion. But any event, I guess that's my explanation, which you didn't ask for, as to why I didn't really go into the state's position on whether or not Jackson v. Deno even applies there. If there are no further questions, we would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The matter is submitted. Appreciate it.